Good evening, and welcome to the Thursday Night Special. Tonight we bring you Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez's talk from September 29th in support of KKFI and his new book, Reclaiming Gotham. We'll let Judy Ansel introduce Juan.
Juan Gonzalez was born in Puerto Rico, but he came at a very young age and was raised in New York City, actually in East Harlem in the Bronx and Brooklyn. It's hard to distinguish which came first, his career as a journalist or his career as an activist. He started with high school newspapers, but then he was involved in the very well-known strikes and occupation during the Vietnam War at Columbia University. He was a member of SDS. I just have to say about SDS, I went to one SDS meeting when I was in college. And I only went to one because they asked me to go get them coffee. And I left. So that was my SDS career. Hopefully his was a little longer. And then he helped to found, after college, the Young Lords and became their Minister of Education. And if you don't know anything about the Young Lords, maybe you'll hear something tonight, or you should look them up because they were a very important civil rights organization of the 1960s. Juan's career of over 40 years was in the corporate media. He worked for three papers, the Philadelphia Daily News, the Village Voice, and the New York Daily News, which he retired from last year. He is famous as an investigative reporter, and his reporting won him two of the very prestigious George Polk Awards. Some of what he did was investigate in the post-911 cleanup activities for the toxic dangers for those the workers who worked in the cleanup and the people who lived around the site of the World Trade Center. He also investigated corruption in New York City. We know there isn't any of that, right? As well as police misconduct. Ditto, none of that. But he found it, and he reported on it. He is a leading Latino journalist and was president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. He's a professor of journalism and public policy, and he has written 4.5 books. They are Fallout, The Environmental Consequences of the World Trade Center Collapse, Harvest of Empire, A History of Latinos in America, which I've used as a textbook at UMKC, and I highly recommend if you really want to understand where our Latino immigrant population came from and why. He wrote a book called Roll Down Your Window, Stories of a Forgotten America, and co-authored, that's why I said half, a book which he says is his best, News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media. And now he has another book out about New York City. He is also featured in the film based on his book, Harvest of Empire, of the same title. Of course, we all know him and love him as Amy Goodman's co-host on Democracy Now!, where he is on a couple of days a week. And having listened to him for years now, I truly appreciate him as a journalist with great integrity who takes his stand on the side of justice. Ever since I read Harvest of Empire, I've been asking KKFI to invite Juan Gonzalez to come, but we had to wait for him to write another book to get him here. And I'm glad he's here. So often journalists today value reporting on both or all sides of an issue, whether or not one side may be true and the other side may be totally fake news. That's what we get in journalism today. And that's why it's so important for KKFI to bring Kansas City Democracy Now!, where there's a constant attempt to dig up the truth, and in that, Juan Gonzalez is a pro. Welcome.
So my new book is Reclaiming Gotham, Bill de Blasio and the Fight to End America's Tale of Two Cities. Before I tell you what the book is about and also to discuss the topic of the night, from sanctuary cities to climate change, how the new progressive revival that's occurring in America's cities, which is more or less the theme of the book, I want to tell you how I decided to write about a bunch of politicians, because quite a few of my leftist friends, especially those in New York City, have been asking, has Juan gone crazy? Why does he want to write about a bunch of politicians? Well, I've spent now 50 years with a front row seat at what is happening in urban America. 10 of them I spent as an activist after the Columbia strike and my involvement in the Young Lords, and then with another group called the National Congress for Puerto Rican Rights, and with the African Liberation Support Committee, and a bunch of other groups that I worked with over the years as an activist. I finally, in my 30s, decided to pursue a career. I'd gotten married, and my wife at the time, who was not political at all, said, "What are you doing? You have a Columbia education. What are you doing working in a factory and doing all this organizing? This family needs to make some money." So I said, all right, well, I'll see what I can do. And I figured, let me try to get a job in journalism. So I did, and I started working first at the Suburban and Wayne Times and in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, and then the Philadelphia Daily News, and then eventually the New York Daily News asked me to come to New York to do a column. And so the 10 years that I spent as a community and labor organizer gave me one perspective on what is happening in our inner cities, because I've also always lived in the inner city. Whether it's the inner city of New York or Philadelphia or Washington, D.C. In fact, I just bought a house in what you would call the suburbs, because when I started teaching at Rutgers University, I had to get a place near the campus. And so I bought a house in New Brunswick, which is it's actually a town, but it's really a suburb. So now I'm experiencing a little bit of what suburban life is like. But most of my life has been spent inner-city urban America. And in the process of my work for these various newspapers, I've learned a lot about how governments function. I've covered a whole bunch of, directly, mayors and politicians, from Frank Rizzo in Philadelphia to Bill Green, his successor, to Wilson Good, the first African-American mayor of Philadelphia, and then to Ed Koch and David Dinkins and Rudy Giuliani and Michael Bloomberg and now Bill de Blasio. Trying to understand and explain to the masses of readers of these publications how our government officials make decisions, what it is that they consider when they're trying to affect policy, whether it's land use policies, zoning policies, budgetary policies, policing policies. So I've had a front row seat at how politics operates in the cities of America. And I've always been frustrated about the enormous potential that our cities have to not only bring so many diverse people together, so many races and classes, but also the vibrancy and the inclusive nature of cities, and yet how polarized over race and class they are. So I've really been working on this book my entire career. But what happened was that in 2013, something unusual happened in New York City. A young former leftist radical who had been an organizer a supporter of the Sandinista government in Nicaragua, had raised supplies and support for the Sandinista revolution here in the United States, and then become a low-level politician, a guy by the name of Bill de Blasio, decided to run for mayor of New York City. He was following Michael Bloomberg, one of the richest men in the world. I think he's like the fourth richest man in the United States. I think Bloomberg is worth somewhere north of $40 billion. And so de Blasio ran for mayor because Bloomberg had already served three terms and could not run again. And he ran against four much better financed, much better known Democratic candidates and was the least likely to succeed, according to the corporate and commercial media. And then he shocked everybody, and he won. He won on a campaign that economic inequality was the moral issue of our time, and that he was determined to end the tale of two cities. In New York, which is a tale of two cities in any major city in America, of a small group of wealthy elites who run the city for their own interests, and the masses of the people of the city are left the crumbs. And so he made that the premier slogan of his campaign. He happened to come around at a time when the whole conversation in America was dealing with the issue of income inequality. Post the Great Recession, post the Occupy Wall Street movement, everyone was talking about income inequality. And here was a candidate who came and said, I'm going to do something about income inequality. And he had a bunch of concrete proposals. So de Blasio wins. I didn't know him well. I didn't even vote for him. I actually voted for one of the other candidates, the city controller, John Liu, who was actually much more radical than de Blasio, but who was crippled by a federal investigation into his campaign finances and so therefore didn't do well at all. So for the record, I did not vote for de Blasio. However, I understood that after John Liu, he was probably the most progressive candidate in the race. And so he won this election. It totally stunned the elite of New York City. So you might wonder, well, why would anybody outside of New York who's not a former New Yorker care about what happens in the mayoral race of New York City? Well, first of all, New York is not just any town. It's the most influential city in America. For decades, the urban policies of New York have influenced urban policy across the nation. It is also the center of world capitalism, the center of the world financial system. It is a city that employs 300,000 people directly. We're not talking governs, employs 300,000 people directly. It has a budget. When de Blasio ran, it was like $72 billion. Now it's up to $87 billion. It has a budget larger than most nations, an annual budget larger than most nations. So in and of itself, the fact that this left liberal progressive had captured the levers of power of one of the biggest governing institutions in the country would be remarkable in its own right. However, as I looked at the de Blasio victory, because he not only won the primary going away, he then ran the general election by 72%. He got 72% of the vote. It was a complete landslide. So, but on the same day that Bill de Blasio was elected the mayor of New York City, a maverick councilman, anti-democratic establishment councilman from Pittsburgh named Bill Peduto was elected the mayor of Pittsburgh. On the same day that de Blasio was elected mayor of New York, a guy by the name of Martin Walsh, the first labor union leader to ever be elected mayor, was elected to this to the mayoralty of Boston. On the same day that de Blasio was elected, a young nonprofit director who had campaigned against subsidies for a new sports stadium for the Minnesota Vikings, named Betsy Hodges, was elected the mayor of Minneapolis. On the same day that de Blasio was elected, in Seattle, a state senator, progressive, more liberal than progressive, but definitely in the progressive direction, by the name of Ed Murray, was elected the mayor of Seattle. A few months before that, the most radical one of them all, Chokwe Lumumba, a former leader of the Republic of New Africa, an outright revolutionary, ran for the mayoralty of Jackson, Mississippi, the capital of Mississippi in the deepest part of the South, and he won the election in Jackson, Mississippi. That was a few months. It was in May of 2013. A few months later, in early 2014, Roz Baraka, the son of the famed African-American poet and revolutionary Amiri Baraka, was elected the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, the largest city in the state of New Jersey. So I'm watching all this, and I'm saying something is going on. Why are all these people, none of whom were expected to win, none of whom had the backing of the established Democratic Party machinery, and many of whom had the same kind of message of attacking income inequality, of dealing with affordable housing, raising the minimum wage, all winning election in these cities. So I said, you know, they say in journalism, 3 is a trend. Well, I had like 6 or 7, right? So I said, there's something going on, and now that I'm a little while later, I decided to retire from the Daily News. I figured I'll have a little more time, you know, because professors work hard, but, you know, they're not under constant threat of a daily deadline, you know, maybe I can spend more time going around and investigating this phenomenon and trying to understand how this happened. So I spent the next year or so traveling to a bunch of these cities, interviewing these leaders, and not only the mayors, but the city councilmen, because there were city councilmen being elected all over the place. And one of the earliest ones was Gail McLaughlin and the Richmond Progressive Alliance in Richmond, California, Gail was elected mayor early on and started doing all of these radical changes in Richmond. So that's what the book is about. It is about something is happening in urban America that is a reflection, I believe, of the people's frustration and anger post the Great Recession and post the Occupy movement about the nature of how power and urban policy has developed in America. So it deals, one, with the rise of de Blasio itself. It examines how it happened and what policies were implemented, what had been successes, and the failures. And the other thing that it deals with is this overall resistance movement. But there's a third aspect of the book which deals with the issue of how did our cities get to be where they are today, so divided along lines of race and class and neighborhoods? How has urban policy, how has government affected urban policy? Because this is what I tried to do when I did my history of the media, is that usually it's not the free market that determines how things develop. It's political decisions that are made by leaders in Washington and state capitals and local governments at each stage along any particular process, and to understand how the problem got to be, you can understand what needs to change. So I started having to do a whole a dive into the literature on urban development to try to get a better handle of the historical record, especially as it dealt with race and class. And what I came away with is a understanding of what this new movement is in the historical context. I don't want to get too esoteric about it, but that basically, you know, I take a lot of my cues from sociologists Malich and Logan in their book Urban Fortunes, the Political Economy of Place, where they took the perspective that most of our cities throughout the 20th century were constructed by the influence of the urban growth machine, that the political and economic leaders of our cities always view the land, because remember, cities are have a definite space, and therefore, in a confined space, the land of the cities is the most valuable commodity. And how you handle the land, how you develop the land, how you decide zoning policies, how you decide development policies, tax policies, really affects how that city evolves. And so the urban growth machine has gone through three major phases throughout the 20th century. The first phase was the classical, conservative, and largely racist phase, where policies, as our cities, after World War I, experienced great influxes of African Americans as the needs of the war drew African Americans from the South in the first stage of the Great Migration, and then during the Second World War, the second stage, the cities became increasingly populated by African Americans. City leaders devised policies to corral these new migrants into ghettos, and they were supported not just by the local leaders, but by the federal government itself. Through the racial supremacist policies that were developed by the original economists and appraisers developed the FHA, that basically said African Americans and Mexicans and other dark-skinned people lower property values. So therefore, you have to confine and restrict them into certain neighborhoods. And you know, Homer Hoyt, Frederick Bacpock, Fisher, these were all the people who became the authors of what eventually became redlining, the theory that you have to keep African Americans and Latinos in any city in certain neighborhoods and you can't let them out. I quote in the book the actual reports and books where they say precisely how that's going to be done. The result was that throughout the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, the federal government systematically encouraged racial segregation in every city in America through its willingness to only ensure housing that was sold to white people. So the result was in Chicago, for instance, up until the 1950s, 85% of all the private housing in Chicago had restrictive covenants that the houses could not be sold to African Americans. In Nassau County, Suffolk County, Westchester County, New York, all these developments that were created after World War II, all the suburban developments, and even the outer city, in the outer areas of the cities, all the new residential developments all had deed restrictions that they could not be sold to African Americans. Levittown, the biggest residential development ever built in America, at one point had over 70,000 people. Not a single person in the entire place was African American. And the government was underwriting
was insuring all of the mortgages for all of these properties. So that the result was that the federal government directly helped to engineer the segregated cities that we had today. And so that was the conservative phase. However, so many African Americans and then Mexicans and Latinos kept coming into the cities that even that those policies were not sufficient. And what started happening was starting in the late 40s and early 50s with the Housing and Urban Development Act of the Housing Act of 1949, the government began to systematically raise the inner city through urban renewal. So urban renewal became basically a way to recapture some of the inner city by getting African Americans and Latinos out, but then pushing them into what were formerly all-white neighborhoods, which then became areas of racial conflict and battles in the 50s in every city in America as whites tried to prevent blacks and Latinos from moving into their neighborhoods. But the blacks and Latinos were moving in because they were being pushed out of where the other areas that they were formerly segregated into. So that became the second stage, this liberal, because the slum, it was called slum clearance. The government promised for every low-income housing unit that it destroyed, it would build another unit. Well, it destroyed all the units, but they never built the housing to replace it. So ever since the 50s, the United States has been in a housing crisis, which it is still in today, because the government kept destroying low-income housing but not building sufficient amount of low-income housing. So I go through all of that, but I think the important thing to understand is the third stage of urban policy, which is neoliberal phase. After the riots of the 1960s, as America's leaders began to realize that the cities were getting out of control, that all the policies of the past had not served to gain control for the local elites of their cities, they came up with the new neoliberalism. And I just want to read just a few graphs in the book where I explain how this is important to understand what the new movement is about. If I can find it, okay. By the 1970s, neoliberalism supplanted the old conservative strategies. No longer could government simply bulldoze entire communities with what civil rights leaders dubbed Negro or Hispanic removal. It became clear as well that our cities, which remained the nexus of the American economy, had to be rebuilt, and that upper and middle class whites must be lured back to inhabit them, with the poor relocated to faraway suburban rings, as had already occurred in Europe's cities after World War II. Congress spelled out that goal in the 1974 Community Redevelopment Act when it called for, quote, the spatial deconcentration of housing opportunities for persons of lower income and the revitalization of deteriorating or deteriorated neighborhoods. Admittedly, there's still considerable debate among urban scholars on the meaning of neoliberalism or whether it is even appropriate in describing local city politics. Here I use the term not as a theoretical abstraction, but to outline a specific political economic project by which capital seeks greater profit through privatizing government services, appropriating major portions of the public commons, and curtailing democratic accountability by public officials to the mass of voters, all in the name of more efficient governance. The third story of this book chronicles the origin and evolution of the new urban resistance movement, of which New York City and the de Blasio Coalition are only the most visible example. Decades of steady displacement of low-income residents from our major cities, along with the constant push to privatize the public commons, eventually gave rise to a sustained public revolt against the neoliberal version of the growth machine. That revolt has been quietly gathering steam for some time. It began more than 15 years ago in a few scattered cities and towns, places such as Richmond, California, Seattle, Washington, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. In most cases, a local advocacy group formed around a particular issue challenged the anti-neighborhood policies of the city's established leaders, then backed one of its own for election to a municipal post, and somehow pulled off a surprise victory. At first, each victory appeared to be an isolated occurrence, a rare and unexpected achievement for progressives. Many thought it due to the particular circumstance of that town or to the qualities of the individual upstart challenger or to the weaknesses of the candidates he or she vanquished. It is only human nature, after all, to fix our gaze on what is immediately in front of us. But in doing so, we often fail to grasp the powerful forces operating in the background. Or as the old saying goes, we miss the forest for the trees. In the case of this new movement, it would take several years for even its key participants to realize they were part of something bigger. So my thesis is that this movement of urban resistance against neoliberalism in our cities has been developing now for more than a decade. It came of age in 2013 when all of these mayors began to capture key cities in the country, but it's been building. No one saw it as a movement, because movements don't hold conventions to announce themselves, right? Movements grow. They grow when two or three people in one place say, we're fed up, we're not going to take this anymore, we're going to challenge what's here, and we're going to do something different. Most of the time, they lose. Sometimes they win. And then when they win, they start looking around. Okay, now that we won, what do we do? You know, and how are we going to, now that we're in charge, how are we going to govern? But, and then they hear, oh, 300 miles away in some other place, somebody did something like, just like we did. And then they find out, oh, yeah, over there in that other city, I just heard from somebody that they're doing the same thing. And then they suddenly begin to realize, oh, we're part of something bigger. They start networking. And they start exchanging information, and that's how movements grow. The public doesn't find out about this most of the time until these movements are already with a full head of steam, and then, you know, some smart-ass reporter like me comes around and says, oh, yeah, let me interview the people, find out how it happened, and let me write a book about it or write an article about it. And that's how the rest of the public finds out about it. But what I'm saying is that there's been an urban resistance movement to neoliberalism developing now for quite some time. It just started to come of age recently. And it's also not just in the United States. In England, they have the first Muslim mayor in London, Sadiq Khan. In Paris, they have a socialist and leading environmentalist, Anne Hidalgo, who was recently elected the mayor of Paris. In Barcelona, they have Ada Colau, who led a movement of Spanish homeowners who were faced with being evicted from their homes as a result of the mortgage crisis, thousands of Spanish homeowners, and they started all this massive civil disobedience and protests, and she was elected the mayor of Barcelona. In San Juan, Puerto Rico, there's this young dynamic woman you've seen, many of you probably, on if you've been watching TV on the Puerto Rico crisis, Carmen Yulín Cruz, who really rose from the grassroots and to be elected the mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico. I believe it's happening in the entire industrialized West as the national governments are increasingly controlled by right-wing and reactionary forces, as the regional and state governments are controlled by right-wing and reactionary forces, that the progressives have begun to build bases, political bases in the cities, because that's the populations that are most receptive to their perspective and viewpoints. And after all, I think it's 50% of the world's people already live in cities, and in another 20 years, it'll be 70% of the entire planet will be living in cities. So what happens to cities is really how cities are governed is really going to determine how the planet functions in the future. So that I believe that there's a message of hope here, that these mayors and these local officials can resist. Now, it's not saying that they're going to be guaranteed of any overall arching victories, but you have to start somewhere. And the only hope for progressive social change right now is in the cities. And that, you know, as Bernie Sanders said when he lost his race to the presidency, run for office yourself. Told all his people, go back home and run for the Board of Education, run for the city council, run for the county commissioner, you know, and begin to build a movement, build a political revolution from the bottom. So that's basically what I try to do in the book. And how it relates to, clearly, sanctuary cities and climate change are two of the prime examples. I believe sanctuary cities is going to become the lightning rod for this entire movement. And as I mentioned to some of the students that I spoke to at the university this afternoon, it's especially going to be happening in Texas, but in all the states, because increasingly, as the government seeks to crack down on sanctuary cities. And in Texas, the state legislature has already passed a law, Senate Bill 4, that basically threatens to arrest any public official who does not abide by requests from ICE for detainers and for undocumented immigrants. Every single mayor of every big city in Texas is opposed to that legislation. The mayor of Dallas, the mayor of Houston, the mayor of San Antonio, the mayor of El Paso, all of the big cities, the mayors are directly against the state legislature. All of the police chiefs in all of those cities are opposed to the legislation, claiming it'll make it harder for them to be able to enlist undocumented immigrants for information about crimes because they won't want to come anywhere near the police. So you have the police chiefs and the mayors of every major city in the state opposed, yet the state legislature has passed the law, and eventually, I mean, it's going to wind its way through the courts. It's, you know, there are court battles now, but if it gets to the Supreme Court, we all know how it's going to end up. And eventually, you're going to be faced with the possibility that the state government will start arresting public officials in Texas who insist on maintaining sanctuary cities. So I believe that this is the reverse of what happened in the 50s over integration. You remember Eisenhower called out the army in Little Rock to integrate Central High School because the public officials in Little Rock were refusing to integrate their schools. John F. Kennedy called out thousands of federal marshals to Oxford, Mississippi. They occupied Oxford, Mississippi for 2 years, forcing the governor and the university officials to integrate the University of Mississippi. So there were direct confrontations between the federal government and local governments over social policy. I think we're heading in that direction. And Texas is going to be the first place that that's going to be fought over. But this time it's going to be in reverse. Back then the federal government was behind a progressive change. This time the federal government is supporting reactionary change. But the confrontation will have to occur. And then more and more Americans will have to deal a lot more deeply with the issue of sanctuary cities. Climate change, the same thing. Cities have and California is about to pass a law declaring the entire state a sanctuary state. What are they going to do with California? So there will be cities all around the country, and there will be the biggest, most important state in the union opposed to the federal government. And I don't think that we should fear those kinds of confrontations. In fact, it will be those kinds of confrontations that will have to force everyone to think much more closely about the ramifications of the policies that the federal government is pursuing. So in sanctuary cities, on climate change, on police accountability, on all of these issues, cities are charting a different course from the federal government. And they have some power. They don't have complete power. Nobody has complete power in the world. But they have power. And they have resources. Now the problem is, you know, a lot of my friends are saying, you know, I was interviewed on one show, one person who remembered me from the Young Lords said, "Juan, when you were in the Young Lords, you would never have supported John Lindsay. He was a liberal. He was a liberal Republican, but one of the better mayors in the history of New York. And now you're saying that it's okay to support de Blasio." And I told him, I said, "Herson, you're absolutely right. When I was 21 years old, I thought a certain way, you know, and now I'm approaching 70, you know, I think I've matured. I've matured. And you know, and I hope that all of us have had an evolution of our perspective over the period of our lifetime. And I understand that some of these progressive leaders are attempting to do the best they can within the confines of what they find themselves in. That does not mean that everything they do should be backed. There's many things that de Blasio has done that I completely disagree with, and I think and others that he's been pushed to do, but he's done it. Like, I think one of the biggest ones is the agreement to close Rikers Island, the biggest penal colony in the United States. At one point, Rikers had about 20,000 inmates, almost all of them awaiting trial. And the only reason they were in jail is because they had no money to pay bail. And some of them were in jail for 2-3 years awaiting trial. Now the population is down to about 8,000 or 9,000. It was the city council, which in many, many respects is more radical than de Blasio, because it wasn't just him that got elected, but others. City council created a blue ribbon commission. The commission produced an amazing report, not only about Rikers Island, but about the whole mass incarceration industry. And it called for the closing of Rikers Island. And when the mayor realized that more and more people were lining up, he said, "Okay, I agree. We'll close it. We'll have to wait a few years till we build local jails in every county in the city, but we will close Rikers Island." So that's an enormous step forward in terms of criminal justice in the city. So he's done some things that are questionable and problematic, but when you compare what the changes that have occurred under de Blasio and under some of these other mayors to what existed beforehand, you would be a fool not to recognize that there are substantive changes that are occurring. And if you begin to declare these people the enemy, when the real and much deeper enemies are the ones that are in the state capitals and in the federal government right now, then you are weakening your own movement. I think that sometimes those on the those of us on the left are right to criticize political leaders and to press them more, but sometimes we don't understand that it's easy to criticize, it's hard to govern, especially once a progressive movement comes to power within the confines of a capitalist society, which has its own limitations of what you can and can't do. Then the question of what are the compromises and what are the concessions that you have to make to move the movement forward is complicated. It's not as easy as it seems. And yes, some of them get corrupted by the money and the power and other things. And so some of them are going to betray you. But you have to look at the bigger picture. that there is a national movement of urban resistance in America, and that has to be nurtured, it has to be encouraged, and more people have to be recruited to join it. So that's basically what the book is about. It's not really about politicians per se. It's about the conditions that gave rise to this new generation of politicians that have come of age in the last few years. Anyway, so I'll leave it there. I know you might have questions about Democracy Now or about the Young Lords or about Harvest of Empire, anything else that I've been somehow peripherally involved with over the years, and I'd be glad to answer that. But I definitely encourage you to get the book, and I think you'll get a sort of a new perspective on what's and also a sense of hope. We need some hope. You know? We need some hope, right? Because you know, things look so dark. Every time you turn on the TV or look at your Facebook post, or you know, or open a newspaper, or however you get your news, it's good to get a sense that there are positive things that are occurring, and that there are all the grassroots movements. But those grassroots movements are making these kinds of changes possible, whether it's a 5 for 15 or, because all of these elected officials are behind the 5 for 15. All of them are behind universal pre-K. All of them are, now they're for affordable housing, but there it's a little tougher because some of them want to buy into the growth machine idea that in a city you got to give developers height for affordability, only how they define affordability is suspect, and how much height they give the developers is too much usually. But they're all, for the most part, against charter schools and the privatization of the public commons, whether it's the parks or public schools, they're all against stadiums. I mean, my best example in the book is Nick Licata. I don't know how many of you have heard of Nick Licata. Great individual. He was in the city council of Seattle for I think 5 terms. He just retired recently. And he was like a former SDS guy from Bowling Green who didn't like the fact that SDS was so elitist, and so he left that and joined the radical commune in Seattle, a commune that existed, he lived in for 40 years, right? Who lives in a commune for 40 years? But he became a councilman, gradually got very respected on the City Council of Seattle, eventually becomes the president of the Seattle City Council. He campaigned heavily against subsidies for sports stadiums. So while he is president of the city council, the Seattle Supersonics wanted a huge new subsidy for a new arena. Now, they hadn't even paid off the subsidies from the last new arena that they had, that the city financed for them. But they wanted a new arena, right? So, and they threatened that if they didn't get the subsidies, they were leaving Seattle. So Nick Licata said, go ahead and leave. He said, not only go ahead and leave, but before you leave, you have to pay us all the money that we gave you in the first subsidy. Right? So the Seattle Supersonics left. They became the Oklahoma City Thunder. Right? And they left Seattle. No one is arguing that Seattle is in bad shape because the Supersonics left, right? But they were one of the few cities that actually called the bluff of these holdups that all these sports teams get into with their cities. So Oklahoma City is happy, I guess, you know. And not as happy as once Kevin Durant left. But I think that that Nick Licata was a hero. He became known as the guy who drove the Seattle Supersonics out of town, right? Which to the city leaders, you know, was a negative, but to anyone who's involved in the progressive movement, that's, you know, that's something to take to your tombstone. But those are the kinds of leaders that we need more of around the country. Anyway, so thank you very much for listening to that.
Are you up for a few questions?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I have a handheld mic. If you want to line up, that might be the best thing right here. And no speeches, please. Let's just get some questions.
All right. Hi. I want to ask you about your comments about public policy that started racial and class segregation. Mm-hmm. So Kansas City was fortunate enough to have a man here who wrote a book called The Color of Law, and he explained the difference between de jure segregation and de facto segregation. De jure segregation being that which is caused by public policy and the law. And he says that in the courts, they keep insisting that segregation is de facto and therefore there is no legal remedy, if I understood him right. So he's arguing that there is de jure segregation and that therefore there could be compensation. So my question is, are you aware of any of these progressive politicians trying to mobilize a fight for recognition of de jure segregation? Because at the talk, he just said, well, go home and talk to your friends. And that, you know, that's not going to do it. We have to have a movement to get it done.
Yeah, on the specific issue of the racial discrimination in housing, no, I'm not aware of any of them that have come up with a plan to actually try to get redress for it. I think that, generally speaking, I mean, the reparations movement that is gathering steam, even though people don't realize that it's gathering steam, is in a broader sense an attempt to deal with the systemic discrimination that continued to occur after slavery. And I think one example that we've had on Democracy Now and that I don't talk about it in the book because I only met the guy. I only met him after I had finished the book. Was what happened in Charlottesville, Virginia. In Charlottesville, I don't know if people are aware. Everyone knows about the whole movement to remove the statue of Robert E. Lee. Well, that was started by one of these young, new elected officials, a young African American guy named Wes Bellamy, who got elected to the Charlottesville City Council just a couple of years ago. And he was the only African-American on the city council. And he immediately began to press to get the statue of Robert E. Lee taken down. The city council didn't want to hear it. But they also didn't want to have a big fight with him over it. So he said to them, okay, you don't want to take the statue down? Give me a reparations package. All right? He said, I want a racial equity fund funded by the city to provide jobs for African Americans, to provide scholarships. The council was so afraid of the Robert E. Lee issue that they gave him the package. They gave him several million dollars. I said to myself, wait a second. People keep talking about reparations at the national level. What about at the local level? Especially in cities where there are large African-American populations. Why can't local city councils create reparations packages at the local level for the systemic discrimination that's occurred in their own cities? So Bellamy got that passed. And then a few months later, he was able to switch one vote on the council, because only five members on the council, four whites and one black. And then they voted to also take down the statue of Robert E. Lee, which was the point at which Charlottesville became a national story, right? Because then the Klan decided to do the march against Bellamy. It was really against Bellamy and against the idea of taking the statue down. But he was one of these young, one person on the council. That's all it took. He didn't have a majority, you know, at first, but he had the guts to keep on saying, I want this done, I want this done, and to organize his constituents to back him. And so look at how what Charlottesville became, you know, just as a result of one person, young guy, I think he's like 30 or something like that, getting elected to the council and then forcing change.
That story may be actually an answer to my question, but this confrontation that we are not to fear between federal and state versus city governments, do you elaborate in your book or can you now? What kind of shape you think that would take?
No, because SB 4 had not been passed when the book went to print. So, Trump had already been elected, so I knew the collision on sanctuary cities was coming, but I didn't expect that it would start at the state level, and I certainly didn't expect it would start at a place like Texas. Because Texas is 35% Latino. It's not like people there are going to like just take this. There are already people organizing, preparing for these confrontations. You know, I know one of the people I profile in the book is this young Greg Kassar, who was elected at 26, the youngest city councilman in the history of Austin, Texas, Mexican-American kid who 10 years ago during the immigration protests was a teenager participating in the protests. He's now one of the most articulate, progressive members of the Austin City Council, and he's already been arrested a couple of times in protest against Senate Bill 4, and he's ready to go to jail right now, you know, if they start to try to implement it. So there's going to be all kinds of confrontations where everyone's going to have to sort of think more about you. It's not just going to be an issue. Oh, yeah. No, you're going to have to decide, is this just to put elected officials in jail because you're insisting that they deport, that they allow all of these residents of their cities to be deported. So I think it's going to be an interesting, teaching moment? it's going to be a teaching moment.
This is pretty simple. At what age can parents in New York send their kids to the pre-K program?
Oh, universal pre-K in New York City is at four, but now de Blasio has said that he wants to do 3K. So his promise is in his second term, because he's up for re-election this year, he's expected to win, but he said that in his second term he wants to take it to 3K. And understand, universal pre-K is not just an educational issue, it's a financial issue. Because you know, the average parents in New York, child care for a four-year-old is about $12,500 a year, about $1,000 a month. The city, the first year, the Bellagio was elected he took office in January 2014. By that September, he had put 53,000 children in four-year-olds in pre-K. The next year was 70,000. The third year, it was 70,000. Now, you figure each of those parents saved 10,000 a year, not 12,500, because during the summer they still had to pay for the child care during the school year. So they saved 10,000 a year. So that's 70,000, 70,000 is 140, and 53 is 193,000 families save $10,000 a year as a result of the pre-K program. It's a huge economic support to the families of and it was universal, not just for the poor. It was for middle classes, for any parents. So all of those families saved that money. So that was a huge economic boost to the city, as well as an additional year of education for every one of those children.
I'm glad you mentioned the Texas bill. I happened to be down there the day after they passed that in Austin. But maybe the topic for your next book, since you're still a kid to me, is what's going on throughout the country where these right-wing, ultra-right-wing Republicans have taken over so many of the state legislatures, because they are doing the same thing that some of the state legislatures did during the civil rights era of the 60s. They're passing preemption laws mm-hmm. and nullification laws. They've done that in Missouri to prohibit cities from enacting their own regulations regarding gun ownership. They recently did it in Missouri just this last legislative session when St. Louis and Kansas City passed minimum wage bills that were much higher than the state minimum wage, which itself is a little higher than the federal, but it's still poverty wages. And they've not only preempted laws where they've said, oh, you can't pass this in the future, but they have what they did in Missouri was an attempt, and so far it hasn't gone to court, I hope it will, is really nullification. Because mm-hmm. we passed it, St. Louis passed it, and they said, oh, we're going to nullify that. But that's happening all around the country, and it is a movement. American Legislative Exchange Council, mm-hmm. of course, is behind a lot of this. They write these laws and give them to their puppets at the state level, and they introduce them and oftentimes pass them. But I think there is hope, not only in the cities, but one thing about state legislative races, they're usually pretty small districts. So even if you don't have a lot of money, because we're always going to be outspent, you know, progressive mm-hmm. candidates are always going to be outspent. But in state legislative races, sometimes they're small enough that you can run a door-to-door campaign mm-hmm. and you can overcome that big money.
Right.
But I think it is a national issue.
Right. But also, I think I understand that here, didn't they get it on the ballot for next year on the issue of the minimum wage?
No, it's right to work.
Oh, I'm sorry, right to work, right to work.
We are also trying to raise the minimum wage to $12
right.
by getting it on the ballot.
Right. Right, because that's what was done in Arizona. In Arizona, the legislature prevented some of the cities from raising the minimum wage, and so the citizens got together, did a huge campaign, and last November, the same time that Trump was elected, Arizona sharply increased the minimum wage across the state because, you know, the minimum wage, anytime you get it on the ballot, that's a winning vote because everybody understands that the minimum wage has lagged way behind what it should be. So it's only a question of the success of getting it on a ballot because once it gets on, it's likely to win.
We're gathering signatures right now.
So I want to kind of go on John's concern there with the ALEC. There's also a city-county exchange thing that they funded and an atlas, a worldwide network. So it's not just working at the state houses. But I'm concerned about the blowback. So when we have progressive issues, there's always a backlash or blowback to them. And I guess in some places like Michigan, even Puerto Rico, I believe, had people come in, executive councils or whatever, and said, well, obviously the people have spent too much money. They can't rule themselves, so we'll have this executive board. And I'm curious, only Guam, as an instructive example of what happens when these Wall Street guys there in New York have already made the decisions for us, and then they just find ways to implement them. And I'm wanting to have progressive gains without triggering a backlash. So I'm wondering if you have ideas on that.
Well, I think what needs to be done there is it's really a question of changing the narrative and changing what the information is that people have. Because, the backlash has to gather support at some point, you know, and in the public. And, the example of Puerto Rico, it is astonishing to me the amount of theft and exploitation that has occurred in Puerto Rico in the current debt crisis, where basically you're having the same situation there that occurred during the mortgage crisis in the United States, where the people who are being blamed are the victims of the theft. To give you just one example, You know, everyone here, Puerto Rico has $72 billion in debt. Right? That's to bondholders, just to bondholders. Now, the Detroit bankruptcy, which was the largest bankruptcy in American history before Puerto Rico, was $14 billion. That was $14 billion to the bondholders and unfunded liabilities to the pension funds of Detroit. Puerto Rico has $72 billion owed to the bondholders. It has another $46 billion in unfunded pension liabilities. The entire pension system of Puerto Rico is bankrupt. There's no money to pay current retirees or future retirees left in the system. So the actual debt of Puerto Rico is about $125 billion compared to Detroit's $14 billion, right? We're talking about a magnitude unheard of in American municipal finance history, right? But much of that debt, of the Wall Street debt, was pure illegal operations that went on. I mean, it was a Wall Street version of payday loans. To give you an example, I spent a lot of time looking into these bond offerings. Bond offerings are amazing instruments once you get into them and you read them carefully. But, for instance, in 2007, Puerto Rico floats a bond for the Puerto Rico Sales Tax Financing Authority, floats a bond for $100 million. Right? That's one coupon, right? For $100 million at 5.25% interest. According to the bond, Puerto Rico did not have to pay any principal on that bond for 53 years. It was a 53-year bond, right? No principal for 53 years. No interest for 53 years, right? So you borrow $100 million, and 53 years later, you owe $1.1 billion because you owe the original principal and the accumulated interest from all those 50 years. Now, who in their right mind gives a loan like that, right? You give a loan like that because you know the government has no money to pay. But because the government had a constitutional guarantee that it would pay its bonds, eventually down the line, you know, somebody else, when you, the dealer who figured that, did that deal, is long dead, will have to deal with the mess afterwards. And these were the kinds of loans, that bonds, that Puerto Rico was incurring. And so the Wall Street firms, the underwriters, the bond councils, they all had to know this stuff. This is like the no documentation, no documentation mortgages, with a teaser rate that goes from like 4% to 9.5% in 5 years, that kind of stuff. That's what was being done. And the governing officials of Puerto Rico, they were so, they didn't know what to do. They couldn't pay their ongoing budgetary requirements, so they kept taking out these loans until it finally dawned on one governor, the last governor who lost his job as a result, when he said, look, there's no way in the world we can ever pay this debt, right? No way. And now the problem is that it's too big a debt for the municipal bond market of the United States to absorb this much money being lost, because it's going to have a ripple effect for the borrowing of every single city and state government in the United States, right? And that's the problem that Congress has. They don't know how to deal with the fact that the borrowing of Missouri, the borrowing of Illinois, the borrowing of all of these other municipal agencies will now be hit with higher interest rates if all of this debt cannot be paid, and the financial community has to, get itself back together as a result of this unprecedented debt. It's a huge problem, and I don't know how it's going to be resolved. Yeah.
My question was kind of similar to that one. It's from somebody that just came back from Rio Piedras. I was wondering, you know, right now we have a budgetary cut with HUD, right? And what would, you know, you say that it's really easy to criticize, right? It's really hard, a lot harder to govern. And so I'm just thinking about a lot of my separatist friends in Puerto Rico, what they would be saying right now, for example, the prior question was of the committee that came in to oversee the funds for the junk bonds. What do you think are some of the more progressive ways that we could use, especially if HUD's gone, now FEMA's in the mix now with two of the hurricanes, and now HUD, a lot of the HUD money is being funneled that way. What are the more progressive things that we could do for an experiment like Puerto Rico that's got the junk bond issue, they got the hurricane issue, and now we have this opportunity now to do some housing stuff?
Well, I think, first of all, that there's no way the people of Puerto Rico can pay that debt. So everyone has to recognize that. Who is ultimately responsible for Puerto Rico? Puerto Rico is a territory of the United States. It belongs to but is not part of the United States. Congress has all the authority over what happens in Puerto Rico. That's why they appointed the control board, because Congress is the body that directly has ultimate control over Puerto Rico. So I think that the federal government is going to have to assume a huge portion of that debt. It's either that or the municipal bond market is going to be roiled for years. And now, people say, well, why? They call it a bailout. Right? The last control board that was established before Puerto Rico was the D.C. control board. In 1995, the federal government put the District of Columbia into receivership. Right, it appointed a control board over the district, and then it ordered the control board to come up with a long-term plan to deal with the structural financial problems that the District of Columbia had. Interestingly, a lot of the attention went to the control board, but not to the report that the control board produced about a year later. What the control board said in that report was that the District of Columbia had a structural deficit that was a direct result of the federal government. Why? One, because there are so many federal buildings in the District of Columbia that are all tax exempt. They pay no taxes. So you have these huge, giant agencies with these huge buildings, and none of it is producing taxes for the district. So by the very nature of the district being the federal capital, the federal government is not paying property taxes. And so that was one issue that the D.C. Control Board said. Unless you do something about the fact that so much of the land in D.C. is not producing taxes, you have a structural problem. The other thing that they concluded, and this is something very few people know, is that in the District of Columbia, there is a height limitation on buildings. No building can be taller than the Capitol, right? So the result is that the district is prevented from doing what every city does, which is to build up, and therefore to develop more commercial and high-rise development. Again, that was a federal decision that had an income impact, a revenue impact on the district. So the control board recommended that the only thing that could be done is the federal government would have to come up with offsets because of its policies that have created the situation in which the district could not pay its bills. So what they did is the federal government agreed to take over the pension system of the District of Columbia, pay all the employee pensions of the district out of its own funds, take over the jail system of the District of Columbia, you know, take over the courts of the district. All these things that previously the district had to pay for, the federal government incorporated into its budget. It was in effect a bailout of the district, but it was a hidden bailout because it wasn't announced as a package. So the reality is Puerto Rico's in the same situation. Puerto Rico, because of federal policies, has been prevented from having the kinds of revenues that it needs. You've all heard about the Jones Act, which is one example, the shipping laws, that everything that comes in and out of Puerto Rico must be on an American ship with an American-made ship with an American crew and an American flagship. The rest of the world is all trading and transporting its goods on ships made in South Korea and Japan with Liberian and Panamanian flags and with Greek and Cypriot crews. That's the entire shipping industry of the world, right? And yet everything that comes in and out of Puerto Rico has to be in American ships, and that forces 30% increase in the price of everything that comes in and out of Puerto Rico. You know, but that's a federal decision that is hurting. You know, it costs Puerto Rico $500 million a year in lost revenue just because of that one rule. And there are other things that the federal government has done that prevents Puerto Rico from being able to manage its own economy. So I think that if the federal government insists on this relationship, then it has to provide offsets. Oh, the other thing is Medicaid and Medicare. All the federal government programs, when it comes to Puerto Rico, are capped. There's no SSI in Puerto Rico. Medicaid reimbursements are capped at much lower rates than any other state. So the government, Congress made these decisions. Congress has deliberately starved Puerto Rico of revenues that it would normally get, and then it blames Puerto Rico for not having enough revenues to pay its bills. Well, you know, you can't have your cake and eat it too, right? So the issue then is you have to create, if you want to keep the current situation, you have to create offsets and make up for the bad results of your policies.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take three more questions. Nobody else stand up. Okay. And then Juan is going to sign some books, but okay. We don't want to wear them out too much.
So you alluded to perverse incentives for developers, or how it can be really abused, and you also talked about the wealth income gap in cities, like with the rise of the creative class and everything, and all across the country. You mentioned Seattle, Austin, San Francisco, New York City. Right now, we have situations where, we're poor people, and blacks and Latinos are being pushed out, being displaced, and so forth. And so Kansas City is at a tipping point right now, where right now there is renewed building and interest going on in the city's core. Now, people are moving in from the suburbs. And so what I want to ask you is, are there any lessons to be learned from watching what's happened in all of these cities? Austin in 2016 had the highest, growth of any city. They also had the largest exodus of people from the urban core, from black people. That were pushed out. Mm-hmm. What can we learn from that with regards to our policy making here in Kansas City to ensure that doesn't happen?
Well, that's the number one question for urban America, is the housing question. Where will the people live? And I think that I quote in the book that there were two commissions in 1968 that President Johnson created. One was the Commission on Civil Disorders, the Kerner Commission, that everyone knows about. There was another commission that he created called the Commission on Urban Problems, which was headed by Paul Johnson, another former senator, liberal Democratic senator. And the Johnson Commission dealt precisely with the issue of housing in America. And it basically said, this is 1968, that the private market, left to itself, will never build low-cost housing. Never. Right? Because there's no reason for them to do it. If they can make so much more money by adding, granite countertops and a few, gizmos here and there, and build the same buildings, with just a little bit more glaze on the outside, then they're going to do it. So as far back as 1968, the federal government understood that there was a housing crisis in America and that it necessitated the federal government and local government stepping in to assure low-cost housing. The problem is that the federal government, by starting with Nixon and definitely after Reagan, completely got out of the public housing business. They don't build any more public housing. The only real public housing program left at the federal level is Section 8, and even that is limited, and that's basically a subsidy for the private market anyway. So there's been no attempt by the national leaders to tackle the housing problem. So therefore, the local leaders have been left to, well, what do we do? New York State for a while had a program called Mitchell Llama, which was interesting and it was good, but it had a 30-year limit, and once the mortgages that the state had subsidized for all of those middle-income housing ended, they all were privatized. They, one by one, they all became privatized. So there's a few that have still managed to survive, but for the most part, they've been privatized. So the issue is then the local leaders figure we have nothing else to do but depend on the goodness of the real estate industry if we give them height to give us a little bit of crumbs of low-income housing. So there's no comprehensive plan to build low-cost housing in urban America, and yet the cities keep increasing in size. New York City had 8.125 million people in 2010. In 2015, it had 8.5 million people. In 5 years, the population of New York City increased by 375,000 people. That's bigger than most cities. Where are all these people going to have housing? You know, same thing in all of these other cities you're mentioning. Now, a lot of small towns in America are declining in population, but Chicago, you know, all of these bigger cities, they're more and more people are gravitating to them, and as you say, those who are lower income are being forced out by the creative class, other people call them the professional managerial class, that have come in and are driving up prices. So there's got to be a comprehensive effort to build low-cost housing in urban America. And if the federal government's not going to do it, this budding coalition of cities is going to have to come up with their own plan, you know, because it's you can't keep up this way.
I'm going to change the subject, but it's still related, and it's about the whole, if we're going to have that progressive movement, mm-hmm. we really need a free press. And as a journalist, I mean, we see so much propagated about all the fake news, and I have friends and family in rural America who believe that all the there's all, every mainstream is all liberal and like Democracy Now, and that's all fake news. And so how do we dispel and educate our population? Because they're the ones getting shafted the most, and we need to help them to be educated, but it's like they keep getting reinforced with lies on a continual basis.
Well, that's a tough one, too, but I know the issue well. Let me say, first of all, it's a complex question. We could spend a whole evening just dealing with that, but I'll tell you this. You have to understand, what are the biggest media companies in America today? It's not ABC. It's not CBS. It's not NBC. It's not the New York Times. These are not the ones that decide what people are talking about the next day or even in an hour from now. The major media companies in America today are Facebook, are Google, right, are the tech giants. I do a quiz with my journalism students at how they consume media every class. And the first day class, I give them an ungraded quiz. I had 29 students in the class in the spring. 23 of them, only one of them claimed to read a newspaper on a regular basis. And these are juniors and seniors, journalism and media majors. Right? Almost none of them watch TV, cable news, forget it. They don't watch any of that stuff. But out of 29, 23 of them admitted that they went on Facebook 10 times a day or more. 10 times? Because I told them, what's your favorite social media site? How often do you go on? Once a day, three times a day, 10 times a day or more. 23 out of 29 went on Facebook 10 times a day or more. The young people today are getting their news and information through Facebook, through Twitter, through Instagram, as their friends send them articles that they have found somewhere else, right? And so Facebook is a hugely powerful media company throughout, because they are the circulation system for media. And as we're learning more and more, it's a system like Wall Street that can be completely manipulated by bots, right? By creating false stories or trending stories, and it can be systematically manipulated. Even the stuff that their friends are sending because they hear it's trending here and there, it could be trending because some guy in Russia had 3,000 accounts that all started circulating the same story, all fake accounts with fake names of people who don't exist or some other part of the world. So it's a rigged system, and it's an opaque system. The algorithms that these companies create to determine what is trending. A lot of the media companies in America today have young reporters that do nothing else but track what's trending in Twitter and what's trending on Facebook to decide what stories to cover, right? They're not actually doing their own reporting. They're only slaves to the algorithms that Facebook and Twitter and these others have created. So it's a tough situation, but we first have to understand how the media system is changing, right? And once we understand how it's changing, then we can figure out how to tackle it. You know, now one of the things that's coming up, for instance, Facebook allows, is it Facebook or Twitter? One of them allows you to have multiple identities, you know, and they don't even track these the whole thing can be gamed. The whole thing of social media can be gamed. So that makes the dissemination of false information even easier. And if malevolent actors abroad have done this, are we to imagine that our own government didn't long ago figure out how to do this, and has been doing it for a long time, and we just haven't found out about it, you know? So I think that it's a tough situation because the media system is rapidly changing. Nobody knows exactly how it's going to, when the dust clears, how it's going to work itself out. But I think the important thing to understand is the power has shifted. Power has shifted. It's no longer in the traditional old legacy companies. It is now in these tech companies that are increasingly buying up the media. They are buying up the media, the content providers. I don't know how many of you have been following that now. Facebook and Apple have both said they're going to invest $1 billion in creating their own original films to go up against Netflix. And that means they're going to be having a lot of money to pay for content. Now, how they're going to decide what the content is, how much of it's going to be documentaries versus feature films, short films. But they are now... These tech companies are increasingly taking over the media. The owner of eBay obviously bought the Washington Post, you know, Comcast bought NBC. So between the cable companies and the tech companies, they are now the dominant players in the mass media in America, not the old legacy media that we used to know as. Last question.
Hi. Thanks for coming to Kansas City. I was just thinking about the Black Wall Street in the early 1900s in the city outside of Tulsa, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of wondering, correct me if I'm wrong, but why haven't we really seen anything resembling that since in black or brown communities? And do you think that maybe some of the zoning laws that you're talking about might have anything to do with that? Or some of the local laws?
Well, I don't know if the zoning laws particularly, but I think that definitely the systemic discrimination that's occurred in lending, because most businesses go from small to big through loans, not through their own money, And if you can't get credit, you can't expand and you can't build. So I think that the discrimination in banking has definitely affected the ability of wealth accumulation in minority communities. And in fact, if you think about it, the original discrimination in housing, the fact that so few African Americans and Latinos, even if they had money in the 40s and 50s and 60s, could get loans to buy houses, when buying a house is the biggest investment most Americans will ever make, and it's the one that accumulates wealth for the household and the family or the children. So if you were completely shut out for decades from participating in the home ownership market, you basically shunted the African Americans and Latinos away from wealth accumulation. I think the discrimination in banking and credit probably is the biggest reason why you haven't seen more, sort of prosperous African American Latinos communities develop. Okay. Well, okay. Thank you.
Well, you certainly earned your money tonight, didn't you? Juan's going to be out front signing books. I want to thank All Souls for all of their great hospitality. I want to thank KKFI's two Bills, Bill Sundahl and Bill Claus, for all the work they've done on this event. And our other KKFI volunteers, stand up, those who are still here, I know. Spencer there. Anybody else? Yeah, all right. In back. Thank you guys very much for your help, and thank you all for coming. And if you want the signature, get in line. Thanks. If you want the signature, get in line.